Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Tuesday's explosive guilty plea by Donald Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, continues to receive wall-to-wall media coverage. Cohen pleaded guilty to 8 criminal charges, including 2 campaign finance violations. Cohen admitted to using campaign funds to pay porn star Stormy Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal in exchange for their silence about their relationships with Trump. Also on Tuesday, Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, was convicted on 5 counts of tax fraud, 2 counts of bank fraud, and 1 count of failure to disclose a foreign bank account. So what do you think about the coverage? It's getting wall-to-wall coverage. What is the real story here? Well, the Huffington Post, Paul Blumenthal writes, Paul Manafort is just a tiny part of D.C.'s lobbying corruption. And the Atlantic's Adam Sewer points out that these convictions serve as a reminder that only some people pay the consequences for systemic corruption in America. Joining us to talk about coverage are 2 reporters. Carrie Levine is a reporter investigating the influence of money in politics at the Center for Public Integrity. Before joining the center, Carrie worked as a research director at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics, where she managed a 5-person staff that exposed the activities of politically active dark money nonprofits and uncovered instances of congressional self-dealing. One of Carrie's recent pieces is called Watchdog Calls for Investigation into Wilbur Ross's Financial Dealings. Wilbur Ross is the U.S. Commerce Secretary, and we'll talk about her report on today's show. Hi, Carrie. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Jim Tankersley. Jim covers economics and tax policy for the New York Times. He has written extensively about the stagnation of the American middle class and the decline of economic opportunity in so many areas of the country. And one of Jim's pieces that he co-wrote with his colleague Michael Tackett is called Trump Tax Cut Unlocks Millions for a Republican Election Blitz. Hi, Jim. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, as we always do on our media roundtable, we start off by highlighting journalism that stood out. So, Carrie Levine, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
It's hard to pick this week. There's
yeah.
been so much wonderful journalism out there. I have to obviously note the amazing work that the Wall Street Journal's team of reporters has been doing on the Michael Cohen story. They just keep breaking news when everybody's on it, which is a very hard thing to do. And I also just wanted to call attention to some of the other fine work going out there on, in money and politics. McClatchy's had a couple of really great pieces this week that should get read about both small dollar donors giving online and about the DNC's struggle to raise money this election cycle. And both were really great money and politics stories.
Oh, the DNC's having a tough time?
They are having a tough time, even as other Democrats rake in the money. And so McClatchy took a really good look at the reasons why.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Kudos to McClatchy and the Wall Street Journal. And we'll find those pieces and put them on our website, yourcallradio.org. What about you, Jim? What did you see this week that caught your attention with so much going on?
Well, this is against my brand as an economics reporter, but I think that the most important policy development of this week was the Trump administration's move to replace the Clean Power Plan with, with a different version. And my colleague Eric Lipton has a really great piece today explaining how the new plan would allow a lot of old, dirty coal plants to continue to operate without what are called scrubbers, which remove a lot of the chemicals that new plants are already removing with these scrubbers. And so essentially, he had people quoted in the piece talking about how this move is sort of like a life extension plan for old polluting plants. And that has real consequences, obviously, for environmental health, for people's respiratory health, for a lot of other things. And so in a week in which the environment was overshadowed by a lot of political theater and a lot of legal drama, I thought that piece did a really great job of explaining the consequences that are on the table for this change in policy.
Yes, thank you so much for bringing that up. That's such an important piece. Eric Lipton, it's called EPA Rule Change Could Let Dirtiest Coal Plants Keep Running and Stay Dirty. And we'll definitely do a show about that in the coming weeks. That's Jim Tankersley. He covers economics and tax policy for the New York Times. Well, let's dive in here and just talk about what's happening. I mean, there's so much happening very quickly. The New York Times broke a story last night about the Manhattan District Attorney's Office possibly bringing criminal charges against the Trump Organization and two senior officials over hush money payments. There have been very detailed reports about Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort, but because things are moving so quickly, again, just to remind people, this was a plea deal, and Michael Cohen admitted to using campaign funds to pay porn star Stormy Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal in exchange for their silence about their relationship with Donald Trump. Carrie, since you cover campaign finance, let's specifically talk about that piece of this, because Cohen pleaded guilty to 8 criminal charges, including 2 campaign finance violations. Can you tell us, what does this mean exactly? What constitutes a campaign finance violation?
Okay, well, a campaign finance violation in this case, Michael Cohen pled guilty to doing very specific things that were unlawful. So, for example, he pleaded guilty to willfully causing an unlawful corporate campaign contribution in one instance, and the other charge was making an excessive campaign contribution. And one of the important things to note here is that a lot of campaign finance violations are dealt with on a civil basis. There's a regulatory agency called the Federal Election Commission. And if they decide there's a violation, they have a process for handling that. There are fines assessed, that kind of thing. The reason this was a criminal violation, and Mr. Cohen himself acknowledged this, was because he said he did these things knowingly and willfully. And so that moves it into the criminal realm. So that's a really important distinction to make here, because I think this week there's been a lot of confusion and discussion about why some campaign finance violations are handled on a civil basis and some on a criminal. And so that acknowledgement that these were knowing and willful violations of the law moved this into the criminal area of the law. So on these counts, they have to do with the arrangement Mr. Cohen made for the publisher of the National Enquirer to pay $150,000 to a woman who claimed to have had an affair with now President Trump. And the payments kept her from going public with the story. And prosecutors essentially said that these payments were a campaign expense, that they were an in-kind contribution from the corporation to the campaign made for the purposes of influencing the election. And corporations are not allowed to make donations directly to campaigns. So that's that first count. The second count, which is making an excessive campaign contribution, has to do with the payment Mr. Cohen made to a second woman, this is Stormy Daniels, to prevent her from talking about her assertion that she had an affair with again, the president. So these were, and obviously $130,000 is way more than a person is allowed to give to a campaign. So in deciding that these payments were made for the benefit of the campaign, that they were essentially made for the purposes of influencing the election, something which Mr. Cohen says that they were, they became criminal violations of campaign finance law.
And Adam Schiff, a Democratic lawmaker and House Intelligence Committee member, said that the factual basis of the plea could add to Donald Trump's legal jeopardy. But Trump cannot be indicted for violating campaign laws. Is that right, Carrie?
You know, the Department of Justice has had the position that the president cannot be indicted. Like so many things in this case, obviously there are people who dispute that, who feel differently about it. But certainly, that would be something that had to get resolved, whether you can indict a sitting president. And also, as I said, the prosecution would have to establish that any violation committed by the president was a knowing and willful violation to move it into the area of a criminal violation. And that's a high hill to climb.
Jim, what do you think is the real story here? Given that you cover economics and tax policy for the New York Times, when you step back and look at what's really happening, The Atlantic's Adam Serr points out that these convictions serve as a reminder that only some people pay the consequences for systemic corruption in the United States. How do you see it?
I mean, I think I would let Adam have his own points on systemic corruption. I certainly think that what we're seeing here, though, is a pattern of, you know, pleas and convictions of people surrounding the president. And I think from a big picture political stance, it certainly calls into question one of the great promises the president made during the campaign, which was that he would hire the best people, bring them to Washington, really change the way that Washington worked for the better and root out corruption. And what the Mueller investigation, which, you know, we have no idea where exactly that's going to end, I think has at least shown so far is that there were plenty of people around the president who were enriching themselves, in like Paul Manafort or others, or you know, who were dealing in all sorts of things that one would not consider to be clean, good governance. And so I think it's a fair question now to say, you know, for the people who expected Washington to be cleaned up and for there to be less influence of money, are they getting what they asked for?
Right. And in the case of Paul Manafort, I mean, this is just the beginning for him, because he's got another trial next month that's going to focus on the lobbying that he did overseas. I mean, he was convicted on 5 counts of tax fraud, 2 counts of bank fraud, 1 count of failure to disclose a foreign bank account. Jim, is it true that, let's say, Donald Trump did not win this election, Paul Manafort would still be doing this kind of business?
It's possible. It's also, I mean, we've certainly seen pretty good evidence in that trial that this was not the hardest case to document, and so it's very possible something else could have triggered this investigation in him. But it is certainly possible that we would not be looking at this entire legal drama playing out in front of us if Donald Trump had lost the election, if a few tens of thousands of votes had gone the other way in a few Midwestern states. Maybe the Justice Department has other things to do. Other people get prosecuted. Other legal controversies are elevated. I certainly think that there is a point here about the selective prosecution of these types of things in the country. And it's, you know, I believe it was Matt Iglesias at Vox had a piece this week arguing that we, you know, the United States just does not in general prosecute enough white collar crime. And, you know, I think that there's a real case to be made on that there's just a lot of, whether it's financial crime or campaign finance crime or lobbying crime or a lot of other white collar things with huge amounts of money are at stake. Those are not as vigorously prosecuted as a lot of other things.
What do you think, Carrie?
I think the selective prosecution point is a really interesting one, especially in light of the Manafort case. There was sort of this fascinating moment when Paul Manafort was charged with violating the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which I think up until then had really been a kind of obscure, arcane statute that only a few lobbying and influence aficionados like me were paying much attention to. And his lawyer said, well, gee, this is a novel legal theory. You know, no one's ever charged with this. And there's some truth to that. I think there was an Inspector General report for the Department of Justice that found that between 1966 and 2015, so we're talking, you know, pretty considerable stretch of time there, the Department of Justice brought only 7 criminal FARA cases. So, it becomes an issue because we do have this law. We do have this law in the books. Like other lobbying and campaign finance laws, a lot of things are dealt with without bringing a criminal case. And then the question becomes, well, are people complying with this law? Is it true that everyone's getting away with it and this is a selective prosecution? And I think in the case of FARA, what you've seen is a renewed push to look at that law, maybe to rewrite that law and to apply it. You're seeing more, the Department of Justice right now bringing more cases against people for acting as unregistered foreign agents or for failing to disclose everything they need to disclose. And lawyers who specialize in this area are warning their clients that the situation has changed, that this is not something to be taken lightly. So I think that you raise a good point. This is a discussion that I think is ongoing, and some of that is sparked by these cases that are causing such a national conversation.
Right. And what do you both think of the national conversation? Because I've been watching the cable shows, and they're on this 24/7, and the main points that they're making, other than looking at the specific details, is how will this affect Donald Trump and how will this affect the midterm elections? I'm not hearing so much among the, you know, the pundit class about corruption in D.C., white-collar crime, who actually is indicted. Jim, what are your thoughts overall about how the media are covering these issues?
I mean, I appreciate you putting the ball on the tee here, and I would like to try to drive it several hundred yards. I feel strongly that the focus of media on horse race politics about whether things are up or down for Donald Trump may be good economics. That is what viewers seem to want, what readers seem to respond to. But I honestly think it is bad for democracy when we are completely focused on these sort of political theater, no matter how important they are. If it's the only thing you talk about, you are missing crucial, important movements in policy. I mean, I would, again, go back to the Clean Power Plant regs this week, which I think were vitally important. I will plug the tax policy space and say there's very interesting new regulations put out yesterday by the Treasury Department that have real impacts on people who live in high-tax blue states and whether they're going to be able to deduct as many of their state and local taxes from their federal taxes next year. It means a lot of money to a lot of people. It has spillover effects on people who give money to charity in other states. I mean, you didn't see any of that on TV. And every once in a while, TV will talk a little bit about policy. Every once in a while, opinion pages will get into the depth of policy. But for the most part, what we are obsessed with as a media culture is who's up, who's down, what does it mean for the midterms, what does it mean for the president, and this president in particular commands that kind of attention and that obsession from TV because he draws ratings, and I think we lose a lot of important discussions in the process.
Exactly, and this is one of the reasons why we brought you on, Jim, because we saw your piece on the front page of the New York Times a couple days ago, Trump tax cut unlocks millions for a Republican election blitz. You write, Republicans are struggling to make the $1.5 trillion Trump tax cuts a winning issue with voters in the midterm congressional elections, but the tax cuts are helping the party in another crucial way, unlocking tens of millions of dollars in campaign donations from the wealthy conservatives and corporate interests that benefited handsomely from it. So what really stood out for you in terms of who got a massive tax cut and how they're spending some of that money on the midterms?
Well, to be clear, a lot of people got a tax cut from this bill. I mean, most Americans got a tax cut, but the benefits of the cut are particularly in the short run being most noticed by shareholders and corporations, and shareholders tend to be the wealthiest Americans. And so what we've seen so far this year, I mean, is a big windfall for a lot of companies who, in turn, are giving a lot of money, many of them, to campaign organizations that support the candidates that, you know, pass the tax cuts. This is, to be clear, exactly how the system works. I mean, there is nothing illegal in that. It's actually, I think, not really surprising that if Democrats are saying they want to repeal the cuts and Republicans are saying they want to keep the cuts, that companies would be for the candidates who want to keep the cuts. But it's also true the companies, you know, one company that we mentioned in the story, Valero Energy, an oil refiner in Texas, they got a $1.9 billion, just in the first quarter, reported a $1.9 billion windfall from the bill, the new tax law. And then they turned around and have spent $1.5 billion helping the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is advertising on behalf of House Republicans running for Congress. So that's a very small amount of their tax savings that they can turn around and use to make a very large impact in elections across the country. And so I think it's very important to point out that these are the mechanics of how the passage of a policy change can trickle through to changes in the political landscape.
Yeah, at $1.9 billion benefit just in the first quarter, and then spending $1.5 million on the midterms. You also point out that the casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, who has given $30 million and whose company Las Vegas Sands reported a $700 million windfall from the tax law earlier this year. And Timothy Mellon, chair and majority owner of Pan Am Systems, a privately held collection of companies that includes rail and marketing services, who's contributed $24 million. So we're talking about big money. Carrie, what would you add just in terms of the money that will be spent on the 2018 midterm elections? We're expecting once again to break records, right?
Yes, and I think actually Jim's story is already out of date because on Monday, I picked up a new file. You know, there was another set of campaign finance filings that came in, and Sheldon Adelson and his wife gave another $25 million, this time to the Republican super PAC that's fighting to keep the Senate in Republican hands.
Oh.
So he's up to $55 million the last time I checked.
$55
million. And so talk to me next week, right?
Hmm.
But so I think the amounts are large. They're only getting larger. But I would also say that, you know, these are in many cases, the same donors who gave so that Republicans who were promising tax cuts and other policy priorities would control Congress in the first place. And they're giving now to keep that. And so I think it's really interesting that the system that we have, as Jim points out, there's nothing illegal about it. There's big donors on both sides of the aisle. They have policy priorities that they care about, and they're giving to the people who they think will reflect that. And so I think Adelson's a great example. He's someone whose policy priorities have gotten a lot of attention. You know, for instance, the moving of the American embassy in Israel was something that he was very much in favor for. There are different kinds of policy priorities. So I think that he's probably pretty happy with how those have been going so far. And so I think you're seeing him open his wallet. And it is absolutely true that when the tax bill was hanging in the balance in Congress, there were a lot of Republican fundraisers for different groups saying, geez, you know, if this doesn't pass, it is going to be a lot harder to get donors to open their wallets, both because donors wanted the tax cut, that they expected the tax cuts. Republicans had campaigned on doing that, and also because the Republican Congress, they felt, really needed to show that it could pass signature policy priorities. And so I think what you're seeing now is the result of that.
And Jim, you point out that a quarter of the group's donations, Sheldon Adelson and the others that you mentioned in your piece, have come through the American Action Network. This is a separate legal entity that focuses on issues and does not reveal donors, but that have spent heavily to promote the tax cuts before and after Trump signed them. This is a group I have not heard about. Can you tell us more about the American Action Network?
I mean, sure, they're an issue group. They're one of these what we call dark money groups. They don't have to disclose their donors. They run ads, you know, basically they can't advocate for or against a candidate, but they can say, call your congressman and tell him that you want tax reform. And during the tax bill, they did a lot of that. They did a lot of pushing for the tax bill, and then they've spent a lot to promote its benefits since then. And I think it's interesting that they and others, you know, very much tout the families, which aren't real, but, you know, as a percentage of the bill, smaller than the benefits to corporations. That's the thing they tout, whereas, you know, I think there's no one has argued to me that the American Action Network is getting tens of millions of dollars in small bundles from middle-class donors happy about tax reform. I think it tends to be what happens is that people with more money and corporations.
I wonder
money,
why not.
You know, yeah, well, I mean, you know, other people in America have other things to do than to give tons of money to political campaigns unless you have a lot of money to go. And it's certainly true that there are small dollar donors all over the place that give to all sorts of candidates, but it is less true, I think, on an issue like tax reform where you've had a really hard time generating much enthusiasm from anybody across the board. Sort of out in the general public, they just don't know a ton about the law still, and it's about even on public opinion. It's not like a huge popular thing. And so, you know, the people who are benefiting most for it are the ones most galvanized, I think, to give money about it. Again, it's like Carrie was saying, it's the system we have. And it absolutely is true that this was the expectation of these groups. Companies have been talking to me about tax reform forever, and you know that they wanted it, and you know they finally got it, and so I think it makes sense that they are turning around and spending this money.
Jim Tankersley covers.
Oh,
hold on, just a minute, okay. Carrie. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come right back.
Sure.
Jim Tankersley covers economics and tax policy for the New York Times, and Carrie Levine is a reporter investigating the influence of money in politics at the Center for Public Integrity. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this. ¶¶
This is Your Call on KLW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, a further roundup of the week's news from your friends at 1A, coming up at 11 here on KLW. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about the explosive guilty plea by Donald Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. We're also talking about Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, who was convicted on 8 counts this week. It's getting wall-to-wall coverage. We're talking about systemic corruption in the United States. A lot of it is legal and legalized money in politics. We're talking with Carrie Levine, a reporter investigating the influence of money in politics at the Center for Public Integrity, and Jim Tankersley. He covers economics and tax policy for The New York Times. Carrie, before the break, you wanted to jump in.
You know, I just wanted to add one thing about the Group American Action Network, which, you know, as Jim reported, has passed contributions to other groups, making it difficult to track them back to the source. This is also a group, like many other such groups, that have spent money directly on influencing elections. For instance, in the 2014 midterm election cycle, it spent nearly $9 million promoting Republican House candidates or airing negative ads against Democratic House candidates. And we'll see if it does the same thing as this midterm election cycle wins on. But it is difficult to penetrate the donors to these groups. In the past, the few American Action Network donors that have emerged publicly were actually healthcare companies. Aetna and HCSC have both been, through different filings and documents, shown to have given some money to American Action Network. So sometimes donors do emerge, but it takes a lot of work, a little luck, and sometimes a misplaced regulatory filing.
And Carrie, you talked about McClatchy's piece focusing on the DNC and the DNC's having some trouble raising money. What about the Democrats? Mm-hmm. What does it look like for the Dems and the midterms and the money they're raising?
That's a great question. So there's a lot of enthusiasm, I think, for Democratic candidates in the midterms in a lot of cases. And Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Times just did a really nice look at this. Democratic congressional candidates are outraising Republican congressional candidates, which I think is interesting. And some of the groups, the Democratic groups that are not the DNC, like the DCCC, which promotes Democratic House candidates, are doing pretty well on fundraising. So I think the Democrats really overall, even though the DNC is not doing well, seem to have the money to compete here. And of course, so do the Republicans. But I think that the Republicans are counting on outside groups in certain ways as their candidates are being outraised.
And Jim, what would you add in your piece about the tax cuts? You point out that the Democrats have their own super PAC dedicated to House campaigns. It's the House Majority PAC, and the group has raised $32 million so far this year. Jim? Did we lose Jim?
Hello?
Hi.
There?
Yes. Are you there, Jim?
Sorry, I'm in a car, and I guess we lost
reception
there for a second. But no, I was going to say, you know, the Democrats have their own big dollar donors, too. I think that the difference here for the Democrats, in part, is they're raising money by talking about not just the president and all the hot-button issues that we've mentioned with his legal issues, but they're just talking, you know, about policy, about protecting the Affordable Care Act, about rolling back some of the tax cuts. And I think that oppositional message is what both these groups, outside groups of Democrats, are spending on, and also I think is driving a lot of their fundraising.
And Jim, what do you think overall about how the media report on dark money because it's been so detrimental to elections. I mean, so many people are so angry at what's happening. So many people don't vote because of this. People just believe the system's rigged, which in many cases it is. Where's the scrutiny on this issue? Let's say, I mean, there are so many different levels of media, right? You've got the cable shows, you have radio, you have print. But what do you think about how the national media report on these issues?
I think the national media actually tries really hard to do a lot of campaign finance coverage. I mean, I think all over the place, you know, we know a lot of really great stuff and very dogged campaign finance reporting. I just think it's hard. You know, you can't force a group that doesn't have to disclose its donors to disclose its donors. And you can do a lot of really backbreaking work to come up with some names and to connect some dots. But it can be very difficult, and I think that that is an underappreciated part of the media landscape now. But I'll tell you where I think it's most challenging is local reporting. I'm a product of a bunch of regional newspapers before I got to Washington. I love regional newspapers. They do not have the staff they used to, and it's much harder to write good, deep dives on campaign financing and fundraising for those in very important local races, whether they're governor's races or congressional races or whatever, state legislative races, even school board races. It's hard to follow the money when you just have, you know, very few bodies and really stringent demands on your time. So I think that is where I worry most about the influence of money in politics that we're not finding out about is on that local level.
And what would you add, Carrie?
I would add that I agree with Jim. I'm also the product of regional newspapers, and I think that it's very difficult for people to find the time to do the work to sort of piece together shreds of evidence and come up with the source of the money. And you know, frankly, a lot of people who put money into elections are counting on that. They're counting on the fact that it's hard, and they're expecting it to go undercovered. And so the other thing that I would point out about that is that very often clues about donors emerge long after the fact. You sit here at your desk as a reporter and you piece together one piece of information from a tax filing and another piece of information from a different tax filing and maybe something from a state record filed with the Secretary of State somewhere for a third piece of evidence, and then you match up the address on a public campaign finance report. And these documents can take a year or two to emerge into the public sphere and until you have the chance to sort of follow that trail of breadcrumbs. And so the other problem is making sure that people have an attention span, that when you come back and say, hey, we figured out who put millions of dollars into that ballot initiative, into that election 2 years ago, that everyone understands it's still important to write that story, even though it's after the fact, that it's still important to look for those patterns and expose that influence because it's going to come back. This is going to be something that recurs, and you have to follow those trails.
Right. Well, and exactly, and that's why independent media is so important. And then I also wanted to ask you quickly just about what happens when this money is misused. In California, Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter and his wife Margaret Hunter pleaded not guilty to federal charges that they misused money. They, according to reports, they illegally converted and stole more than $250,000 in campaign funds to purchase goods and services. There's a long list of these allegations. And then, Carrie, you're also reporting about a 115-page complaint by the Campaign Legal Center calling for an investigation into U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross's financial dealings. Can you quickly tell us what's going on there?
Sure. Well, Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross is someone who came into public office with very complex personal financial holdings. I think there have been some questions raised about whether or not his net worth was accurately reported by him over the years, but he was a billionaire, he was a business titan, and he came in with very complicated holdings. And so I think the questions being raised by the Campaign Legal Center and by others is whether he's accurately reported and disclosed his finances in the way the law requires him to. In addition to that, Secretary Ross has acknowledged that there were a bunch of holdings, stock and other investments that he had, that he was supposed to sell by a certain date to avoid conflicts of interest while in office, and he failed to do so on time. So that's led to a lot of questions about whether he may have violated conflict of interest laws. And, you know, the Campaign Legal Center and others are basically saying, look, the American people deserve to have faith in their officials. They deserve to think that people are doing things for the public interest and not for their own private interests. I wrote a story in July about one holding that Secretary Ross had failed to divest when he was supposed to. It was between $10 and $50 million worth of stock in a company called Invesco. And so between the time when he was supposed to sell it and the time when he actually sold it, the value increased by a substantial amount, you know, by seven figures. Hmm. So his lawyer has said that his failure to sell it was an oversight. He thought it had been sold. It wasn't intentional. The market was up overall. If he had put it in a different approved investment, he would still have made money. And all of that is fair to point out, but the fact remains he was supposed to sell it. He didn't. It went up in value. And, you know, this is something that is not supposed to happen when you take public office. So what you have is the Campaign Legal Center and other watchdogs requesting investigations into Senator Ross. Senator Ron Wyden, who's the ranking Democrat on the Finance Committee, has asked the Department of Justice to investigate. Senator Thune of South Dakota is a Republican who heads the Senate Commerce Committee, and he's asked the Inspector General of the Commerce Department to investigate. So I don't think this is the last that we've heard of this.
Wow. Well, we will definitely continue to follow this. Carrie Levine is a reporter investigating the influence of money in politics at the Center for Public Integrity. Carrie, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for your time, and thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And Jim Tankersley covers economics and tax policy for the New York Times. Jim, thank you for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. And now we are going to talk about coverage of Afghanistan and talk about why violence there is on the rise. Joining us now is Ali Latifi, a freelance journalist based in Kabul. He has covered stories in Afghanistan, Greece, and Qatar, and he reports on migration and refugee issues. He's joining us from Istanbul. Hi, Ali. Welcome back to the show. Hi, Ali. Are you with us? Ali, do we have you? We're trying to connect with Ali in Istanbul over Skype, so hopefully we have a decent connection. Ali, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for joining us, Ali. So you are in Istanbul covering really the horrible treatment of thousands of Afghan refugees who have been deported. Many have spent months on a dangerous journey to Turkey, and then they were forced to return on a five-hour flight. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But first, let's talk about what is happening in Afghanistan. The violence is rising. The Taliban and ISIS have attacked schools, police and security forces, mosques. Just recently, 50 students were killed in a school in Kabul. Ali, what is behind the rise in attacks by ISIS and the Taliban?
As always, when these attacks sort of, you know, increase, it's a way to show their strength and to, you know, really sort of instill fear in the people. Because what it shows, for instance, so if we're talking about the so-called ISIS forces, like in the eastern city of Jalalabad, in about 4 weeks' time, they staged as many attacks in a major city in the country, purposely targeting that one city. And then in Kabul, just about a week ago, they targeted a training center for the college entrance exams, which, you know, as you said, at least 50 students, 50 people who were there to try and improve their lives and advance, you know, their lives and advance the country, were targeted and killed in that attack. One of the attacks in Jalalabad targeted a midwife training center. Another one was very close to the regional hospital in that city, which covers the entire eastern zone. So it's really showing, you know, that they're targeting, especially in terms of Daesh, or ISIS, they're targeting not just the current generation, but the future generation. You know, they're trying to show that they're that they won't allow a future to advance in our country. So it's a very clear messaging that, you know, they're still powerful and that they can still incite fear in the people, and that the government really can't fight back against them. It's a very smart, you know, messaging sort of strategy.
The editor-in-chief of Afghanistan's One TV broadcaster told Al Jazeera, quote, "There is a suspicion that the Taliban is using ISIL's name to decrease the public pressure when it comes to these kinds of very brutal attacks on civilians, especially young children," end quote. Ali, tell us about these kids and why was the school targeted?
I mean, these kids, this school, the area, I mean, I don't know, you know, this what the editor-in-chief of One TV is saying, it's a common rumor in Afghanistan, and there's really no proof of that. So, you know, I think we should just take that as a rumor. But in terms of why they were targeted, I mean, one part is definitely, you know, the messaging. You know, these were kids that were literally trying to improve their lives, that were trying to, you know, they're studying for the college entrance exams. And then because this was a Daesh orchestrated attack, it was in a predominantly Shia area of the city. It was an area predominantly of the Hazara minority, who are, again, majority Shia. So in that case, it was a very specific sectarian attack. And over the last few years, every attack that has been sectarian in nature, these Daesh forces have been claiming responsibility for them, because they are very purposely trying to create this sectarian tension in the country, and they're very purposely targeting Shia majority areas or the Ashura festival, festivities. And all of these other things that very specifically target the Shia minority in the country.
You know, Ali, just one more minute on these kids. I mean, this is just so sad. There's a piece in the New York Times called Dream of a Better Life in Afghanistan Ends in a Hilltop Grave for Students. And they report that most of the students at the center moved from villages to spend a year in Kabul to prepare for their exam, and their families saved so the children staying in $15 a month hostels in Kabul could pursue a dream, a good education as their ticket out of poverty and isolation.
Exactly. And these are the kids, because earlier you brought up what's going on in Turkey and the EU. These are kids that can't afford to make that journey. Even if they try to go into debt, which a lot of the ones who do make it into Turkey and the EU do, it's almost impossible for them. So for them, the closest thing, the one way to try and better their lives, because they come from more rural areas, they come from less developed areas, areas that the government isn't necessarily paying attention to, their one chance at improving their lives is to come to Kabul, to live in these hostels that, believe me, are not in very great condition. You know, $15 a month may not seem like a lot if you're sitting in California, but for someone coming from a village, especially from the kinds of villages these kids were coming from, it's a lot of money. But it's all, again, like I said, this idea of trying to create a better future.
And two of the kids who were killed were twins, Atuala and Farzana, age 19.
Right.
What message does this send to other students, Ali? What are you hearing from young people?
I mean, that is the message, right? The message is that, I mean, the one thing is, you know, despite all of this, people are still continuing. They're still trying because, again, you know, this area of the city, Dasht-e Barchi, because it is it is a predominantly Shia area, it has been so targeted by these Daesh forces who are trying to create sectarian divisions in the country. You know, but people still go on with their lives there, and there's, you know, they still went to these training centers, and they still, you know, were hoping for an education, and they still were trying. But it does bring into question, and it does sort of, you know, make you second guess these things. Because on the one hand, you're trying to create a better future for yourself and your country. But on the other, it's very likely that, especially in this case, that you would not just be killed, you would be targeted and killed.
Ali Latifi is a freelance journalist based in Kabul, and he's joining us from Istanbul, where he is covering the deportation of so many Afghans who spend months getting to Turkey, and then all of a sudden they're placed on a plane, a five-hour journey back to Afghanistan. Ali, the figures on refugees and people being displaced is really staggering. Last year, the war displaced more than 400,000 people in Afghanistan. And since January, Iran and Pakistan have deported 463,000 Afghan refugees. And that doesn't even include the number who are being displaced from Turkey or deported from Turkey.
Right, exactly. And the one thing we have to remember also about the displacement numbers is that those are internally displaced people. So those are people who, because of what's going on, so for instance, what went on in the southern province of Ghazni a couple weeks ago, that would displace thousands of people to other cities around the country because the violence was so bad, they would have to go to another part of the country. But, you know, wherever you go, they're not equipped to handle this amount of displacement and to really provide services for the people who are fleeing conflict from one area and going to another. So that's one major issue. And then if we're talking about, you know, sort of the issue of refugees, it's what we've been saying all along. It's thousands of people, the vast majority of them going into debt to try and finance their trip out of the country in hopes of seeking asylum in the EU. But because of the way that the EU and Turkey and the Turkey agreement has played out, and because of the changes in their policy, a lot, most of them are basically stuck in Turkey now. Whereas in the past, they would be stuck in Greece. Now, most of them don't even make it into Greece. They're stuck in Turkey. And what's been going on since the start of 2018 is that as soon as these refugees make it into Turkey, they're essentially just arrested upon arrival. As soon as the police notice them and see who they are, they're arrested, they're put in these detention centers. I've talked to people who have talked about being abused in the detention centers, about not, you know, of being there. Some are there for days, some are there for months at a time with no real resolution or explanation of, you know, will they be deported? When will they be deported? Will they be given a chance to seek asylum? There's no real information. It's basically you get into Turkey, you're detained, you're put in this detention center, and then you're either put on a flight back to Afghanistan or you're put into this weird sort of asylum process where they give you a date to sort of start the process that's 3, 4, 5 years in the future. And in that case, you're not allowed to leave the area you're in. And a lot of these places that the refugees first come to are more remote areas where they don't know anyone, where there aren't job opportunities, where there isn't proper health care, and they're just stuck there potentially for years until their case can begin. So it's a major, major issue.
What happens to people in the refugee camps?
So in these detention centers, they're basically thrown into these detention centers. You know, I spoke to people who said, for instance, in one of them, there was in the beginning of 2018, there was something like 4,000 people in that one detention center. And then when I spoke to them in May, it was down to about, I think, 700. And so in that time, all of those people were deported. And what that comes down to is that literally hundreds of people are deported every day from Turkey. Mm-hmm. So there's the Turkish Airlines flight. For instance, when I was coming back from that last trip, last May, my flight, there was 100 deported refugees, all young guys, you know, of every ethnicity, just being dispersed around the plane. Usually what happened in the past is that when they were deporting refugees, they would put them very quickly in the back of the plane so no one could see. But in this case, the plane was so full, there was no space. They were sitting, you know, right next to everyone else on the plane. The Turkish one of the Turkish ministries responsible for immigration and refugee issues has a Twitter account where they were posting pictures of refugees that they were deporting sitting in business class because they had run out of seats in economy.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's to that level. I mean that ministry about a month was posting pictures of kids being deported from Gaziantep, from Istanbul, from several other provinces. And, you know, they sort of had like these photo ops where they show the refugees very happy and waving in the planes, and some of them were actually sitting in business class. But, you know, when we talked, so everyone on the plane I was in, you know, because we were all literally, everyone next to us, there were people that were being deported. And so when you talk to them, they had no idea what to do. You know, they were scared because they didn't know what they were going back to. Many of them didn't necessarily have families in Kabul, and they didn't know how to get back to it, whatever province they may be from. So it's a very, you know, scary experience, very tense experience. When they got to the Kabul airport, when we got to the passport line, that's when I counted and I realized it was more than 100 people being deported on that one flight. And one of the passport workers looked at them and said, "What do you have? Do you have a passport? Do you have some kind of document? What do you have for us to process?" And one of the refugee guys, he made a joke. He's like, "We have everything. Of course we have everything." And as they were walking out of the airport, they were discussing with each other where to go. Should they go to the IOM? Should they go to the International Organization of Migration? Should they go to the refugee ministry? Should they try and go somewhere else? You know, it's literally confusion. It's fear and confusion while you're on the flight and once you land. And as we've seen, you know, the Kabul airport has also been targeted itself.
Wow.
So you're not only deporting people to a country where, you know, the violence is increasing. The airport you're sending them back to, the airport they have to leave to get out into the city, has also very recently come under attack.
Well, Ali, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I really want to thank you for all your reporting. This deserves so much more attention, and we would love to have you back soon. Thank you
sure,
so much.
Thank you.
And we should mention, according to Foreign Policy, the U.S. military has 8,000 troops in Afghanistan. The U.S. is spending $4 million every hour on planes, drones, bombs, and guns just in Afghanistan. The U.S. war there is well into its 17th year, 17 years since the U.S. invasion. Ali Latifi is a freelance journalist based in Kabul, and he was joining us from Istanbul reporting on migration and refugee issues. Go to yourcallradio.org to find more of his reporting. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us.